Today on Maine Calling, the mysterious and valuable eel. The story of the eel is an epic tale. These snake-like fish were around way back in the dinosaur days. They've long existed in diverse habitats all over the world and have been cooked and eaten by people across the globe. But through the centuries, some basic questions about eels and where they come from have stumped some of the greatest scientific minds, from Aristotle to Sigmund Freud. I'm Cindy Hahn, and today I'll talk with the author of a new book about the eel's fascinating history, a story that leads to modern-day Maine. The coast of Maine is home to one of the very few successful eel farms, and fishing for baby American eels, or elvers, has become a major industry here. All about eels and why they matter on Maine Calling, coming right up.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self, mainehealth.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Eels are not exactly cuddly creatures, but over the centuries, they have inspired awe and curiosity. In recent decades, they've also played a significant role in Maine, where elver fishing and farming have put Maine on the map. Joining me today to talk about the elusive eel are Ellen Ruppelschell. She's a journalist and the author of several books. Her latest is Slippery Beast, a true crime natural history with eels. Ellen is a professor of journalism at Boston University and is a regular contributor to The Atlantic magazine and other publications. Deirdre Gilbert is director of the Bureau of Policy and Management for the Maine Department of Marine Resources. And Daryl Young is a longtime elver fisherman. He founded the Maine Elver Fishermen Association. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about eels or about elver fishing? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Ellen, I'm going to start with you. Congratulations on the book. It's really fascinating. You've written several books about things like health and the economy. So how did you decide to dedicate this big part of your life to learning about eels?
Well, Cindy, first of all, thanks for having me. Second, you're absolutely right. I did dedicate quite a bit of my life to this topic. But to answer your question quickly, I did not find eels. Eels found me. And let me explain how that works. So as many of your listeners know, winters in Maine can be pretty tough. And it was particularly tough on my house in Maine. So eventually, my husband and I felt we needed to get someone to help us with a leaky roof and the leaky basement. And we hired a guy who in the book I call Sam. Now, Sam claimed to be a wonder with power tools, but if this was ever true, his wonders ceased with us because Sam used to quit early and not show up and come in late. And some days he'd pad into my kitchen with a 4-pack of cider just to tell me stories. Well, Sam had my number. I'm a real sucker for stories. And Sam used to tell whoppers, tell especially about his own family and his grandson, who he told me he wanted to teach to fish. But to do that, he had to save money to buy a boat. And so I said, Sam, why don't you mix business and pleasure and get yourself a commercial fishing license? And he said, well, I would have done that. In fact, I did do that, but not anymore because of the eels. Okay. And I said, what do you mean eels? Are you worried they're going to bite? And he said, nah, eels don't bite as far as I know. And even if they did, I'm not talking about the eels big enough to bite. I'm talking about the baby eels, you know, the glass eels, the elvers. They're about the size of your finger. And ever since the price of those things went through the roof, it's gotten dangerous down by the water. So I said, "Sam, what do you mean the price has gone through the roof?" And he said, "Don't you know? They're selling for about $2,500 a pound." And ever since that's they've gotten so expensive, so costly, people are carrying guns. It's just all sorts of trouble. It's too much trouble. I'm not fishing. So Sam, you know, told a lot of stories. A lot of them were tall stories, tall tales. Didn't quite believe him. But after he left, I kind of looked into it. And it turned out this time he was right. At the time, and still, the trafficking of baby eels, illicit selling and buying of baby eels, was the number one wildlife crime on the planet. And as I looked into this, I found not only is there an incredible human story with baby eels, but there's an incredible story in terms of its natural history. The people who worked with the eel were curious about the eel. It was just a treasure trove. So I have to say, I have a lot to thank. I have Sam to thank for this, and I'm very grateful that he opened this cabinet of wonders to me.
Well, yes, and the elver fishing aspect is certainly something we're going to talk about a lot today. But since you did, as you said, delve into a lot of this history of the eel, let's get to some of that before we talk with our other panelists about the fishing aspect. The actual history, starts in prehistoric times. We're not going to go back that far, so we'll fast forward maybe 600 million years to Aristotle, because what amazed me in this whole section of the book is the history of scientists. Some of the greatest scientists of our times couldn't figure out where the eel came from and how they reproduce, and that's still a mystery today. That is amazing to me. So can you just touch upon some of the big names? There was Freud as well getting involved with this.
There's just a litany of big names involved with the eel. It really surprised me. I had no idea. Going back to Aristotle, so Aristotle, like many people of his time, really wondered about the eel because the eel was ubiquitous. There were eels everywhere, yet no one had ever seen them reproduce. No one had ever seen an eel egg. And no one had ever seen an eel in the ocean, in the open ocean. So how did these creatures reproduce? And Aristotle's theory was that they reproduced by spontaneous generation. They just popped up, you know, out of nowhere. And this was a theory, this whole spontaneous generation theory, that continued as recently as the mid-1800s, you know, and the eel was the primary example of this. Because no one, and to this day, by the way, no one has found an eel egg in the open ocean. No one has spotted eels mating ever. The scientists I've talked to, contemporary science, modern day scientists, are still on a quest to find out for sure how the American eel in particular and the European eel, how and where they breed. It's an incredible mystery that's considered one of the biggest mysteries in biological sciences. So, and you mentioned Freud. Freud's first published work was about the eel. He was charged with finding the male reproductive organ in the eel. And he didn't like this. He was a 20-year-old medical student at this time, and his boss made him do it. He had to dissect. He disemboweled 400 eels before he, in fact, did find a tiny male reproductive organ, which disproved the theory at the time that all eels were hermaphrodites, because he did not find a female organ in that same eel, right? So at that time, he actually did find this, but once he was done with this, he ran away from the eel and went to humans.
Well, after you've cut open 400 or whatever,
And he
and
tells
I.
funny. He wrote letters home about it. He's quite funny. He drew pictures of eels and eel insides, and he thought himself quite above this task. But nonetheless, he did it. It was his first professionally published paper was on the eel. And again, as I said, many contemporary scientists are also involved in what is called solving the eel problem, the age-old eel problem, the question of the eel.
Well, so much more to ask you about all of that, this history of eel as food, but I want to get Daryl into the conversation since you did bring up the question of where the eel came from. Daryl, you know the eel pretty well. Talk a little bit about the eel that is here in Maine, the American eel. What's it like? What's it look like? What does it do? You're pretty familiar with that.
So the American eel, they come up the coast and they go into all the tributaries, little brooks, streams, and rivers. And the more body of the water, the more eels you have. And they come here and they go into the fresh water and start feeding, turn black, and live here for, the males live here for 6 years. And they go back to Sikasko Sea. And the females will stay here from 12 to 15, sometimes even 20-year-olds. And then they'll go back in the fall out to Sikasko Sea. And they go in the deepest part of the ocean, drop down, and the pressure squeezes a spawn out of them. But they wrap up in a great big ball, like a worm ball. You've seen worms gather together, I'm sure. And they wrap up the same way, tangle themselves all up, drop down in the ocean. The pressure squeezes it all out of them. Then they die. Then all the spawn mixes together, and they hatch, and it all starts all over again.
Yeah, so the fact that that's all happening, that the reproduction is happening in the Sargasso Sea, is what people figured out, but you can't really see them doing it, so that's why there's a lot of mystery. And then it's also unusual, too, they go all the way to Maine, up to freshwater, and then go all the way back to Sargasso Sea, right? Yeah,
right.
Deirdre.
So they start in South Carolina, and they go in every tributary up the whole coast right to Canada. And that tells you how many eels there are.
All right. Deirdre, I wanted to bring you in, too, to add to that as far as the whole, the unusual fact that Maine is this place that elvers kind of wash in from so far away. What does that mean? I mean, is Maine unusual in that way?
Well, I think what makes Maine unusual is that Maine and South Carolina are two of the only states on the eastern seaboard that have had a fishery for elvers, and Maine's is much more substantial than South Carolina. They have a very, very limited take, but the Maine Department of Marine Resources manages that fishery in conjunction with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. And so a lot of the work that the department does has gone into just making sure we can maintain that fishery and make sure that our fishery is sustainable and enforceable and providing a benefit to people living along the coast of Maine.
Right. And we're going to jump back and forth a little bit because there's so much to all of this. But Ellen, I wanted to go back to you about what makes these little baby eels that we fish in Maine, what makes them so desirable? What happened in the history of eel as food that led to them being something in such high demand?
Well, the number one consumer of eels, people will not be surprised to know, is Japan, right? So there are three kinds of, there are over 800 species of eels, okay? So they're tremendous numbers of eels, but the commercially viable eels are the Japanese eel, the European eel, and the American eel. So the Japanese eel became highly endangered in the early 2000s and became very restricted. Then the European eel also became critically endangered. It's no longer legal to export the European eel outside of the European Union. So that leaves the American eel as the source, a major source of exportable eels in the world, right? And as has been said, the only seriously, you know, major fishery for baby eel in the United States is in the state of Maine. Right. They, you know, South Carolina is a tiny fishery with only 10 licenses. Maine has about 425 for state fishermen. So it's a much, much bigger fishery. And because of that, the demand for that eel, because of sushi in the United States, the popularity of that contributed to it enormously. There's quite a demand for cultivated eel, not wild eel. Wild eel is not desirable at all. It's a very, very small market for wild eel. But cultivated eel, farmed eel, is very, very desirable. And most eel is farmed in China. Okay, so it has this crazy supply chain where it's, in the case of the American eel, it's harvested on the main coast. You know, when the season is just opening, March 22nd is the first day. It's harvested along the main coast and in Canada. And then it's shipped to China as an infant, you know, as an elver, a tiny, tiny creature, where it's grown up on ponds in China, about 1,000 farms in China, and then sent back to the United States. Okay, so you can see how expensive this process is. It's a highly, highly expensive process. The supply chain is crazy, and again, a highly, highly desirable species. So that's the reason it's so expensive. It's endangered in Europe, highly endangered, endangered in Japan, considered by many scientists to be endangered in the United States as well. And for all sorts of reasons we can get into later. So it's highly desirable, and that's the reason it's so expensive.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. And let's go to now on the line with us is Casey Clark, Resource Management Coordinator with the Maine Department of Marine Resources. Thanks for calling, Casey.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. And your work involves researching the eel's life cycle. And what does that involve? Tell us about that life cycle and how do you go about monitoring them?
Sure. Well, you've already touched on it a little bit, but elvers come back to Maine's coast. They get spread along the east coast by the currents of the ocean. And so once they reach Maine's coast, they start to migrate up into our streams and eventually make their way into bodies of water, ponds, things like that around the state. Folks generally think about them when they hit the coast as maybe just stopping there, and I'll sort of disprove that right off the bat here, that they make it all the way up into really far reaches in the state. We actually have documentation from Inland Fisheries and Wildlife that eels make it up above Rumford Falls on the Androscoggin River and up above many of the projects on the West Branch of the Penobscot River as well, even though there is an upstream passage at many of those dams for eels. So our project specifically, where we look at the different life stages of eels, we look at them when they migrate back to our coast and count them as they enter at one specific life cycle study site that we have down by Booth Bay Harbor. So we count them as they come into that specific pond, so as elvers, and then release them upstream into the pond. And then throughout the summer, we set out traps in that pond and capture yellow eels. So those are the immature eels that are growing up, swimming around eating fish and insects within a pond. They'll do that for between up to 10 and 20 years, depending on how far the pond is. And actually, females end up spending a lot more time in freshwater than males. They grow a lot larger before they migrate out as mature adults. And then the fall, usually when we have fall rain start to come, the eels start to migrate out, the mature ones, as they go down to the Sargasso Sea to spawn. And so we have traps that we set out to capture them at that point as well. And this really is getting back to something that's already been touched on, is that eels are really tough to study in terms of knowing how many are produced and how productive they are, because we don't really get to see where they go out to spawn. We don't get to see how many adults are really going out there because they're so cryptic. So we're using this one specific life cycle study. It's been something that was developed by the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission as a part of our approval for our elver harvest every year, to document at this one specific place what we're seeing in Maine in terms of that, not just return, but also the productivity of those eels in our freshwater.
So
And then we also look at, can I
go
add in
ahead,
one
go
more piece
ahead.
here?
Yeah, go ahead.
And then I'll wrap up. The other thing we do look at is we actually look at information that the harvesters collect. So for each harvester, when they go out and put a net in the water, they tell us when they put that net in, for how long it's in, and how many eels they capture during their harvest. And how easy it is for them to catch is really shows up in that data when we look at it. And we compare both our life cycle study to what they catch, and we've really seen the same thing over the last 10 years, which is that we've had increases in returns of elvers to the state, across the state, not just at our one life cycle place, but everywhere across the coast where elvers harvesters are out there with nets.
So, can you extrapolate from that? I mean, are there trends that tells you about how their population is doing?
In general, in Maine, what we see is that we do see really, over the last 10 years, we've seen that elvers are increasingly making it to our state in higher numbers. So more elvers are coming to Maine than they have 10 years ago, as opposed to last year. So we do see increases here. And what was touched on earlier in terms of the listed status of eels, they're not listed as endangered, but But there are concerns in other places along the Atlantic coast, specifically in some of the southern states and mid-Atlantic states. They really don't see very many elvers return, and we've been on a number of calls with scientists about this, and even just sharing a photo of the number of elvers will capture in a day at our life cycle study is sort of kind of shocking to some other states where they may not see that many elvers in an entire year in their state. And so we do see them pretty, I would say, almost prolifically come back to our main coast.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, thanks for sharing that data with us and for calling in, Casey. Casey Clark.
Can I add something to that? I think mm-hmm. it's really important for listeners to know. You're absolutely right. They seem to be doing better in Maine, which is wonderful news. Less well down in the more southern states, which is also true. The problem is we're not exactly sure why they're declining in the southern states. They're declining in other places. You know, the American eel exists all the way from the Caribbean to Greenland. Okay, so it's got a very wide range, and it's endangered. It's not technically endangered, but it's in danger the entire time. The journey back to the Sargasso Sea is over 1,000 miles. And in that journey, the silver eel does not eat at all. It lives on its own body. It consumes its own bones. And by the time it gets back to the Sargasso, it's really just a husk that, as mentioned earlier, just kind of spawns and dies. So it's a very treacherous journey. So we need an awful lot of elvers to make it into the freshwater along the coast of the United States and elsewhere for them to survive and thrive as a species. So scientists are really concerned. It's true that things are better in Maine, but scientists are really concerned about the American eel and the prospects for it, especially given global warming and other things that have messed with the currents that these little tiny elvers require, you know, rely on to make their epic journey. So I don't want to alarm people, but I do think we have to be conscious that in Europe, it's dangerously endangered, the European eel, which is very similar to the American eel. And we do have to have concerns about protecting the eel.
Thanks for that context, Ellen. And thank you, Casey Clark, for calling in. He's the Resource Management Coordinator with Maine DMR. And it is time for us to take a quick break. We're talking about eels. Our number is 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. We are learning about eels, the mystery that surrounds them, and what makes them such a lucrative catch in Maine. My guests are elver fishing expert Daryl Young, Maine Department of Resources Policy Director Deirdre Gilbert, and science journalist, professor, and author Ellen Ruppelschell. Her new book is about eels and is called Slippery Beast. Join the conversation. Do you find eels creepy or intriguing? Are you wondering why elver fishing is such a big deal in Maine? Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or on Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We have some folks on the line. I'll be speaking with Passamaquoddy tribe Fred Moore in a moment, but let's first go to a call from Stephen from Amherst. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hi, this is Steve from Amherst. I'm a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employee and worked on several petitions that were submitted to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list American eel as endangered. So the one in 2015 was, I think, the last time that came before the service.
I see. So what insights did you want to share about how eels, the health of their populations and where we can see them?
Well, just to expand on comments from a couple of your previous guests and callers, American eel are widely distributed all the way throughout all of the Caribbean, northern part of South America, the east coast of the United States, all the way up the Mississippi River as far as Minnesota, and northward, as was noted, to Greenland, Labrador. And throughout that range, when the eels come back as little juveniles, they're known very well for their life history in freshwater, where they, as was said, swim many miles upstream, finding habitat in streams and lakes and so on. But they also, many of them never even enter freshwater or enter it periodically and end up living in estuaries or even fully in marine habitat. And that was one of the chief difficulties in assessing the status of the population. And it is indeed one, what's called panmictic population. They all breed together. That one population, we know a great deal about freshwater life history, but we know very little about their life history in brackish waters and in marine waters. You can kind of figure this out. If you can get a hold of them, you can look at their bones, particularly their ear bones, and assess the accumulation of strontium versus calcium, and that'll tell you where they grew up. And that can be very specific, their year-to-year growth and so on. So there's a lot that's not known about them, and that was difficult in assessing their status for the Endangered Species Act.
Sure, that is seems to be the theme with eels, a lot that's not known still all these years. Thanks for your call, Stephen. That was Stephen from Amherst. And let's go now to Fred Moore with the Passamaquoddy Tribe at Pleasant Point. He is advisor to the chief and principal author of the tribe's fisheries management plan. Thanks for giving us a call, Fred.
You're welcome.
Give us some context as well about how eels have played a part in tribal history and culture over the years, even as a food source, but also just as a symbolic sort of element for indigenous people.
Yes, throughout their range, American eels and other types of eels are a large part of tribal life, culture, history, in that eels play a central role in many ancient ceremonies and obviously ongoing ceremonies with tribal folks on the St. Lawrence River, up and down the East Coast. You have many clans within tribes that are named after the eel, such as the Eel Clan, throughout its range. So that speaks to the importance of eel to indigenous people. And as a food source, it is very important, and for medicinal purposes. Many of the same folks that I'm mentioning, I'm not going to speak to specific tribes, but I am aware of the fact that aside from the dozens of place names that are named after eels, the tribes in these regions have, like I said, clans, and those clans would conduct ceremonies with the eels, and members of other clans, which are animal names and in nature, that interact with eels, such as otter and fisher and other animal clans, will also use eels in their ceremonies. And then, like I said, for medicinal purposes, eels have been a large part of our culture.
And I know you spent years developing an elver fishing management plan that you had certain goals for, but part of what you just explained, the history and the culture of eels for Wabanaki people, informed that plan. Can you tell us a little bit about what your goals were for what elver fishing management could look like?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, starting out, we have been dealing with impediments to access by indigenous people. Newcomer society has been very busy attempting to displace indigenous people from their traditional activity since newcomers arrived here. But we recognize the challenges to continued access, but also I touched on the fact that there's also a spiritual relationship between indigenous people and all of the species within the marine environment. I'll speak to that environment only so far. And that spiritual relationship places indigenous governments in a position of responsibility to ensure that eels are able to thrive within their environment, and they are not simply a commodity or a species that we can go and exploit to the point of collapse. However, that is what we saw going on. And then you add environmental degradation, barriers, impediments to passage, and artificial barriers, all posing a threat to the ability of eels to thrive. So when we developed our plan, we sought and received input from the oldest living members of the tribe, who had the most traditional knowledge, if you will, in the various interactions of our people with eels, and found that there still and there remains a very deep sense of responsibility not to exploit eels to the point of collapse. So we balanced that those values and value systems with the economic interests, if you will, of tribal members. And so that served as the guide for developing the plan, which also called for a moratorium on the taking of adult eels, except for very limited ceremonial purposes and educational purposes. Also, it enabled us to draw a greater appreciation with the threats of out migration to eels posed by dams. Mm-hmm. And we then instituted an eel restoration plan, which in essence was, I would say, somewhat modeled after efforts in other countries around the world, which happens to be ongoing and taking place today, but not in North America.
Right, Fred. I think we're going to try to talk a little bit more about that in the show as well, other efforts to get around dams and things like that. But it really is helpful to hear your perspective today, and I'm going to let you go. So Fred Moore is with the Pleasant Point Passamaquoddy Tribe. He serves as advisor to the chief. He developed the tribe's fisheries management plan. And Deirdre, I want to turn to you because, you know, obviously it's been the whole idea of the eel quota and balancing things with the tribal needs and priorities and with the other non-tribal fishermen. So where does that land now with what the quota is and how you figure that out?
Sure. It's elvers are a very intensively managed species in Maine, I would say. So there is a quota that is allocated by the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission that I mentioned earlier. They're the ones who set our annual quota. And that's been the case since 2013, I think was the first year, or sorry, 2014 was the first year that we had a quota. So we've been managing under a quota system for over 10 years now. We started at a little over 11,000 pounds, 11,749. Starting in 2015, we've been at 9,688 pounds annually ever since then. How that gets allocated between state license holders and the four federally recognized tribes is based on a statute that the Maine legislature passed that created percentages that go to each licensing authority. So just under 22% of our annual quota is allocated to the four federally recognized tribes. The remainder of the quota is allocated on an individual basis to state license holders. So every year the department goes through a process where we take that portion of the quota and we allocate a specific amount to each of our 425 state license holders. Their original quotas, we derived those by taking an average of what they had landed over these three specific years as we were entering into the quota system. It was 2011, 2012, 2013. We looked at each license holder's individual landings. We dropped their lowest year. We averaged the other two. And then we took a percentage off of that to get us under that quota cap. So this is the only fishery in Maine that we have these individually allocated quotas for. And the reason that was so important for this particular fishery was that given the high value, we had a lot of, in those early years that Ellen had referenced, beginning in 2012, we had a lot of poaching activity, unlicensed people trying to catch eels. So we really needed to create an incentive that an individual license holder had their own individual quota. And the best case scenario for them would be that they would catch that and sell it directly to a dealer themselves and not be part of any sort of illegal trade of eels. A key part of that, in addition to allocating quotas, we had to develop a technology that we could use to track people's quotas and their sales. So we developed a swipe card. Well, in the early days, we called it a swipe card system. It was literally like a credit card that a harvester was issued. They ran it through a device that the dealer used, and that recorded every sales transaction of Elvers and gave that information to the department so we could monitor landings in real time against our quota. And we would turn off the cards as people reached their quotas. And that was really the mechanism that we had to develop and defend at ASMFC as making sure that this was all very closely tracked and kept Maine within that quota that we had been allocated. That took a lot of changes to laws over that time. We started in 2012, and I would say literally every year we kept making iterative changes to our laws to make sure that we were closing all the loopholes and really doing everything that we could to defend that our system was completely airtight to make sure that all elvers that are caught in the state of Maine are accounted for through the entire supply chain until they leave the state, literally on a step-by-step basis, from the harvester to the dealer, between dealers to the exporter. All of those steps are very closely monitored and tracked.
Wow, very challenging with all the competing interests and the numbers to figure that out. But thanks for explaining that. We do need to take another quick break. We are going to go to Sarah Rademacher with American Unagi after the break. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. The American eel starts its life in the Sargasso Sea, and while still tiny, it arrives in the Gulf of Maine and continues on toward freshwater to grow. Many are caught during elver fishing season. We're learning about that process and why it has become so significant for Maine's economy. Here to talk about that today are Deirdre Gilbert with the Maine Department of Marine Resources, Daryl Young is a former president of the Maine Elver Fishermen Association, and Ellen Ruppel-Shell is professor at Boston University and journalist, and her latest book is Slippery Beast, all about eels. Share your comments and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or you can call 1-800-399-3566. And now on the line with us is Sarah Rademacher, founder and CEO of American Unagi. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Cindy. Glad to be here.
So you are seen as a pioneer for being the one person who seems to have succeeded at growing eels here in Maine, rather than just having the elvers that are caught sent off to Asia. What motivated you to figure out a way to pull this off?
So about 10 years ago, I had, you know, have a career in aquaculture and had been growing fish and other seafood in, you know, the U.S. and also abroad, and wanted to live in Maine and, you know, was looking around for a fish that made sense to grow here. And I saw what was happening with the elver fishery with, you know, we have this really valuable resource. All of those eels are getting exported overseas, mostly to farms in China. They're growing them there. And then we're importing back eels from there for our sushi industry, and oftentimes at 5 to 10 times the value that they leave our state. So to me, it seemed like a big opportunity to connect my skill set in aquaculture with domestic grow out of our eel fishery. And it's been a long journey, but we now have a 27,000 square foot commercial eel facility in Waldoboro.
Yes, so it's land-based, but it's on the coast of Maine. Describe what it looks like, the tanks full of eels there, and then what kind of timeline it is from when you get these tiny little glass eels to growing them big enough to eat.
Yeah, so I think this was referenced, but the aquaculture industry for eels has been in existence for a long time, and recirculating aquaculture, or land-based aquaculture for eels, has been in development in Europe since the 1980s. So what we did was, you know, brought that technology over from Europe to the state of Maine and applied it to our American eel species. So we grow eels year-round. Everything's indoors in recirculating aquaculture. So we're constantly filtering and cleaning the water and reuse 90 to 95% of our water. And so we've got a bunch of different tanks. It takes us anywhere from a year to 3 years to grow out an eel. So it's a big investment up front, but ultimately it's been really rewarding to grow, you know, our local eel out here.
I'm trying to envision how many eels in a tank.
It really depends on the size, but on our farm now, we've got around 2 million eels of various sizes. So everything from, you know, a few inches to, you know, a pound or bigger. And the other unique thing that we do at our site that is also somewhat even unique in comparison to the European approach to farming is we also value add process our eels. So we're not only able to grow eels out, we can sell them whole and live, but we can also smoke our fish and fillet them out. So that allows us to supply a couple different types of eel into the U.S. market.
Yeah, I did want to ask about that. The name of your business is American Unagi, and unagi is the Japanese word for freshwater eel, and we've seen it on sushi menus. So tell us what you actually do with it to create that end product. How do you prepare it?
It really depends. So I think it's been referenced, you know, there are species of eel all over the world. And that was one wild thing to me when we started this business, was realizing that, you know, Japan and sushi are really a known way that eel is consumed. But it's, you know, I found that all across Europe, smoked eel is a big thing. And that's one of my favorite ways. With our raw fillets that we sell, that is frequently becomes kabayaki and ends up in sushi. So it's grilled and a very sweet sauce is used versus smoked eel, which is, you know, a nice, salty, savory version of eel that goes really well with its high fat content.
Yum. One of my favorite foods, actually. Thanks for joining
us,
awesome. Sarah. Yeah, I'm a fan. Sarah Rademacher founded American Unagi, an eel farm based on the coast of Maine. Good to talk to you, Sarah. Ellen, I know you, in the process of reporting for your book, you tasted a lot of eel. Are you a fan of eating it?
Totally. I mentioned a restaurant I went to in Paris that's called Eels. And the reason the gentleman, the chef, started that restaurant was because his family caught eels, but his grandmother cooked very, very poorly. So he wanted to show how eel, domesticated eel, he uses domesticated eel, could be cooked properly. But let me say something there, where, you know, responding to Sarah and to Fred, okay, putting those two things together. Fred was talking about how important the American eel is to Native Americans, and absolutely true, of course. Part of the reason for that is because the eel can be smoked, as Sarah mentioned, and salted and preserved over the winter. So in Maine and Maritime Canada, the eel was an incredibly important food for indigenous populations, and they also introduced it to the colonists. It's even thought that eel was on the Thanksgiving table in Plymouth, and more prominently than turkey, although that is a theory, and I don't know if it's true. I don't think anyone's been able to prove it. But the eel, if you look through the literature, which I did, was incredibly important to not only the Native American populations here, but early American colonists, okay, because of the fact that it is so fatty, It is easily, so it's very nutritious. It has vitamin A. It has all these elements to it that people really need. And also because it was so easy to preserve, right? And in fact, there are even novels that discuss how without eel, populations would have died in the Maine winters in particular, the Canadian winters, because they survived on this. So eel was more than symbolically important. It was literally important.
Sure. I'm going to go back to you, Daryl, to talk about fishing, because we've been circling around all this, but we haven't actually heard about how you fish. So, and we've got other callers and we're running out of time. But Daryl, if you can just kind of explain the process of actually catching the elvers, what do you do?
So I've been fishing for 30 years and just took it up. So we set a flight net, and it's 30 feet long, and it'll only take a third of the brook. And so we have spots where we set our nets and fish and catch our quota. And so, before the quota, we would pull our nets in the month of May, May 1st, and we would head to Penobscot River and the bigger rivers and set up our nets up there and catch eels.
So it's kind of
basically
a fun,
let them run in the spread.
It's a funnel-shaped net that you know where they're going to be swooping up in the current, right? You know where to place them. And,
right.
And how much comes into your net in any given night?
No, it varies. You know, like beginning of the season, you know, you might start catching a half a pound. And then as the water warms up, you start getting a pound, 2 pounds, 3 pounds. I've caught 52 pounds before one night.
Well, was that when they were $2,000 a pound?
No, that was actually 2014. It was $1,000 a pound. I needed 40 pounds. We went to Penobscot River and set three nets and caught 52 pounds and had to throw back 12 pounds.
Gosh.
Caught my quarter.
That's why they called it like winning the lottery at that period of time. But people also can hand
right.
dip, right? Even if you hand dip and you get a decent number, you can still
right.
do pretty well.
Back in the 90s, we had five nets and you could have a dip net. So I did
right.
a lot of dipping back then. But when 99 come, they put a moratorium and cut it back to two nets and it took a dip hold with us. Well, we had a choice, but we wanted to dip or use a flight net.
And do you keep secret where you go, or does everybody know where the good spots are?
Back in the 90s, it was very secret rule all the way up till 2012. But ever since we've been put on a quota, a lot of guys help each other.
Yeah.
It's definitely been a different fishery since we've been put on a quota.
I see. Okay. Let's go to Doug calling from Montville. Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi. I've got a question for the experts. I have caught eels over the years. And I've always heard that if you took the heart out of an eel and put it in a glass of water, it would beat for a very long time. So one day I did that. I cut the heart out and I put it in a glass of water in the evening. I came downstairs in the morning and the heart was still beating all by itself. So I'm wondering,
wow.
yeah, so I'm wondering, is this being studied anywhere? My thought is with genetic engineering and things coming down the road, this might be something worth studying. So I'll sign off.
Something for Jackson Lab.
What'd you say, Daryl?
Something for Jackson Lab, maybe.
Yeah, it does seem like eels have all sorts of strange supernatural traits, right, Ellen, from what you've studied?
Well, yes, eels are magical. I mean, eels can, believe it or not, they can exist on land for quite a long time. They can kind of breathe through their skin and slither across. They have survived unbelievable obstacles and they can go up dams. I've never heard of this story, and I'm sure it's true, of a heart beating in a glass jar. I don't know if there's any research on that. There's actually very little funding for eel research in the United States. As one European scientist told me, you Americans don't give a damn about eels. He did say that. Europe has a much more robust, Japanese also, much more robust scientific effort around eels. Although we certainly, Maine does have representation there. So that's a good research project, and I hope someone gets into it.
So much to know still about eels. And Ellen, in your book, you ask the question, what does elver fishing have to do with the balance of the universe? It does feel like eels have to do with a lot. So we've learned just a portion about that today, but we are out of time. So thank you all for joining us today. Ellen Ruppelshell, who you just heard, is the author of Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels. She teaches journalism at Boston University and writes for The Atlantic Magazine and other publications. Deirdre Gilbert is director of the Bureau of Policy and Management for the Maine Department of Marine Resources. And Daryl Young is a longtime elver fisherman. He founded the Maine Elver Fishermen Association. Today's sound engineer was Jessica Miller, and our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.